I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. If you want to have a long career, there are better choices of work than being a playwright. Besides the usual ins and outs of the muse singing, the unpredictable, unfathomable tides of critical fashion which can run out on you as swiftly as they lapped your ankles with praise, there's the harsh reality of the theater's economics. Small wonder that so many playwrights flower young and then fade, going off to Hollywood, to development hell, or writing sitcoms. Edward Albee has beaten the odds on playwriting longevity, beaten them handily. For more than four decades, he has been writing plays that find audiences and win honors. Three Pulitzer Prizes in three different decades. The plays among them, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, A Delicate Balance, Seascape, Three Tall Women, The Goat, or Who is Sylvia? And they've all become part of the dramatic history of the United States. Edward Albee is my guest this hour, Connection listeners. Do you go to the theater as much as you used to? Is it still an important part of your cultural life? How have Edward Albee's plays made you examine your own life, your own family, your own marriage, your own values? Does the theater provoke and tantalize you, or are plays today just too safe? That's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, the number to join in the conversation with Edward Albee, who joins me now from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. Good morning, Edward.
Good morning. Gee, I wish I'd taken that number down. I'd like to call in and talk to me.
Well, I bet you talk to yourself all day long.
I do.
And I'm willing to bet that even while we're talking, you'll be talking to yourself, trying to figure. Now, that's interesting. When you are up and just about, are you also observing yourself and making notations for the other characters that may pop out of your head someday?
I don't think about myself very much. I never have. I keep my eyes and ears, and I hope my mind open to everything that's going on around me. Like, for example, I've never written a play about me. I write a play about other people. But, of course, whatever I write is filtered through the limits of my own perception, you know, the limits of my own intelligence. But I don't write about me. I write about other people and things that I think people should be thinking about.
What things do you think people should be thinking about today? And is it wildly different than what you thought people should be thinking about, say, in 1959, 1960, when you first broke onto the scene?
Well, in 1959, we were eager to get rid of the Eisenhower administration and put Kennedy in office. We accomplished that. I think the major thing today is to get Bush out of office and put Kerry in as president. Aside from that, there may be some things of somewhat lesser value.
Well, leaving the politics aside, the direct presidential politics aside, these things that you say are of lesser value, they are actually the stuff of much of your writing. What is it that's important to you to be saying today? And is it different than it was 40 years ago?
I don't know that it's any different. I wish that people would spend more of their lives awake, alert, concerning themselves with their responsibilities socially and politically and sociologically to their society and to themselves. I wish people would stop sleeping their way through life and skidding along the surface. I wish people would participate in their own lives fully. And I guess most of my plays are written to encourage people to do that, no matter how tough it can be.
But it's interesting because when I think of your plays, I think of them you know, as being in domestic settings, and those the words you just listed were all outside, in society, deep social concern.
Society is made up of people in domestic settings. Most people live in homes and relationships, and they function from that base. And whether or not they participate fully in being alive or in their own society is determined at home in that base.
When people think of your work, they'll probably always be thinking of Virginia Woolf and other dramas that have a domestic edge. How do you say that you're always looking at others and not thinking about yourself? How do you view marriage?
Marriage, define it, please. a legal piece of paper, a relationship where two people try to make a good life together. Define marriage for me.
How about George and Martha's marriage in Virginia Woolf? As a paradigm of marriage.
In that play, you had two very bright people who came together in their late 20s, early 30s, and made what seemed to be a very, very good marriage in a university, a college setting. Stuff started happening eventually. He seemed to be, accomplishing less in his career than she, the daughter of the president of the college, thought that he should. Things started happening. They turned out that they were childless, that they could not have a child. And it's interesting that in the course of the play, it's never revealed which one of them could not have a child. So eventually one night, after a few drinks, they invented a child. We better get home from this party early. It's time to put the kid to bed. And that started off being fun and, compensatory, but fun at the same time. And so they kept on with it, and they kept raising the child, and they raised the kid for 21 years, this non-existent child. Though I would think by the time the child was about 10 or 11 years old, maybe 12, puberty, the game started getting a little ugly, and they used the child as a weapon against each other. And what happens in the evening that the play occurs, of course, is that the child is exorcised on the eve of its 21st birthday with a hope that maybe, without this fiction, which had become a destructive fiction, starting off as a useful and interesting one, that maybe without this fiction, maybe they'll be able to save their marriage. I really don't know whether they can or not.
Well, let's hear an extract from the film version with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
Miserable. My baby, I did it all for you. I thought you'd like it, sweetheart. It's to your taste, blood, carnage and all. I thought you'd sort of get excited, sort of heave and pant and come running at me, your melons bobbling.
You have really screwed up, George.
Oh, come on,
I mean it, you really have.
You can sit around with the gin running out of your mouth, you can humiliate me, you can tear me to pieces all night. That's perfectly okay, that's all right.
You can stand it.
I cannot stand it.
You can stand it. You married me for it.
Elizabeth Taylor is Martha, Richard Burton is George, and Mike Nichols' film version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
We got most of the words almost right.
Now, there is the playwright speaking.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, but the energy was right, and they didn't miss the broader point of that exchange, though.
No, they didn't. But what was interesting was all the background noise that was going on during that scene. For some stupid reason, the people who were making the film thought that they had to move it from the claustrophobia of the living room, and they took it out to some sort of a sleazy bar in the suburbs, and they're in the parking lot for some dumb reason while they're doing that scene. That was all the background noise. Yes. Nonetheless, that scene was done well.
And it's the point of it. I remember seeing it when I was a teenager and marriage was far from my mind, and thinking, if this is what it comes to, that, you know, at some point the woman will turn to the man who's in agony and say, you can take it, you married me for it, that this was not a happy view of marriage.
Well, and of course he says that's a desperately sick lie. Marriage, like all things, all propositions, should continue so long as it is useful and good for the partners. When it starts being destructive, then something's got to be done about it.
Family life is a constant theme of 20th century American drama, mid 20th century American drama.
Well, not only that, all drama is about family life in one way or another. Whether we're talking about Shakespeare's royalty or the Greek gods or whatever, it's all about this domestic relationship.
But what strikes me is it's particularly about family, and frequently about immigrant family. It's not what you write about. Immigrant families falling apart as the immigrant father pursues the American dream at the expense of being a good parent or a good husband. But in your drama,
you know, there are very few plays that are any good, really, in any ultimately useful social sense, that are written about a bunch of people sitting around getting along well with each other.
Well, come on, there are comedies, right?
Yeah, but most useful comedies are severe social criticism, masquerading as fun.
Right. Your own family life, I mean, you grew up in very interesting circumstances. Did it inform your work at all?
Well, I suppose it must have. I was an orphan. I was adopted when I was 2 weeks old into a wealthy family just outside of New York City. Let's be gentle about me and them. They didn't know how to be parents, and I guess I didn't know how to be a son. And the relationship did not work out. I left home when I was 18 and was a much happier person having done so.
But does that has that colored the way you look at marriages? Again, going back to what said at the top, that you don't look at yourself, you look at what's outside you.
I think probably being an adopted kid and having a relationship with a family that my allegiance to was not by blood probably gave me a greater objectivity.
A greater objectivity in writing about family relationships.
In writing about families and being able to distance myself, that my view of what I wanted to write about was not colored by the things that usually restrain people who come from happy families.
Going back to the beginning and then working your way to the present, do you notice, when you look back at your earlier plays, I mean, do you look back at them? I mean, that should be the preliminary question here.
Yeah, but I don't think about them as being early. Yeah, I guess I do.
I mean, you go back and look at your work. I mean, some people, some artists don't. They say, I went through that and I didn't.
Yeah. Fortunately, a lot of people keep liking to do the early ones as well as the more recent ones. So.
But do when you look at them, do you notice differences in the way you invented situations, for example, to make points about family?
I guess, again, objectivity comes in here. I guess I can be pretty objective about what I did in one play. But I try very hard not to think too much about the corpus of the work, so to speak. Whenever I decide that it's time for me to write another play, I can't think about how it relates to the previous plays that I've written. I try to write the first play that I've ever written. I also try to write the first play that anybody's ever written, but certainly try to write the first play that I've ever written so that I'm not restrained by anything that I may have done before.
That's very interesting, but you have to concentrate very hard. I mean, you've had a very long...
Not really.
No.
Not really, because whenever I write a play, I am not concerned about what it is about, the meaning, the symbolism, anything. I concern myself with the absolute moment-to-moment reality of what is happening to real people in a real situation.
Fascinating. It's a wonderful gift, I think, to have in your 70s, to be able to write as if for the first time. Connection listeners, we're talking with Edward Albee, the playwright. We've been talking about family. When we come back, I want to talk a bit more about the theater, the differences in the theater between when Edward Albee first broke on the scene, the late 50s, early 60s, and the way it is today. Do you have any questions for Edward Albee? This is your chance to ask them. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. Back after the break with 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner Edward Albee. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour with Edward Albee, playwright. We're talking to him about everything, and we're talking to him about very much what he wants to talk about. I like that in a guest. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. Just before the break, Edward, you were telling me that, you know, when you sit down to write, it's as if for the first time. You never consider the full corpus of your work going back all the decades. And that's a very good skill to have, to be able to forget all that. But interestingly enough, your most recent...
Well, not forget it. Put it to one side.
Well, yes. I know, but it takes a lot of concentration to do that. Not to think, well, gee, I already did that 3 times already.
Well, if you can't concentrate on your work, you're not going to get it right.
Exactly. But the interesting thing about your most recent work is that it does actually hark back in that one of the very first plays that got you notice was a one-act play called Zoo Story, and I'm willing to guess that even as we speak, in some audition room somewhere in America, some hopeful would-be actor is doing a monologue from Zoo Story, trying to impress
I know. Some 22-year-old kid who was far too young for the role of Jerry.
He's doing it, Matt.
Is playing it like a real self-indulgent, self-pitying kid rather than the real Jerry, who's 38 and existentialist. Aside from that, yeah, a lot of people are doing it, sure.
But what I'm saying is that the Zoo Story is a just a core part now of the American dramatic canon, and you've now essentially written a first act for that one-act play to make a full play. And I think
It was always a full play, but you mean a play that goes on the entire
evening. Well, for two acts, yeah. And they can sell ice cream in between them. The thing is that a lot of people would say, what happens next when they come out of the theater? But you're sort of telling them what happened before.
Well, I think any audience that comes out of any play, having had the experience of it, if the play is any good, they're going to take the play away with them and think a little bit about maybe even about what happened to the people after the play is over. In Zoo Story, of course, there's only one of them alive. The other one's dead, so they can't think about anything except the one that's still alive. What happened was, I'm perfectly happy with the Zoo Story. You know, I'm very grateful to it. It got my career started. It was the first play I'll admit to, and had its world premiere in Berlin, in Germany, and then was done in New York in 1960. Ran a long time, and I quit my job delivering telegrams for Western Union. Not that they noticed. And I'm very happy about that play. But one thing I did notice from the very beginning, that the play is sort of one-sided. We know a good deal about the character Jerry. And the only thing we know about the character Peter is Jerry's point of view about Peter. The character of Peter is a little underdeveloped. He's sort of a backboard for ideas to be banged off of. And I was commissioned by the Hartford Stage Company to write a play to be done with the Zoo Story. And just like that, light bulb went off over my head. Hey, why not write a play about Peter at home with his wife, Anne, just before he goes into the park where he's sitting reading a book and he's accosted by Jerry? And that's what I did. But the interesting thing here was, even though the Zoo Story is 45 years old now, at least, when I started writing Home Life, which is the first part of the full evening play, Peter and Jerry, I knew still exactly who Peter was. I didn't have to reinvent Peter. I'd carried with me. Obviously, okay. To write the character of Peter 45 years ago, I had to know a great deal about him, even though I didn't put much in the play. When I started writing Home Life, I still knew everything about the character Peter. That's fascinating to me.
Let's hear two extracts from the current production at the Hartford Stage Company. Let's hear first Zoo Story.
You're a very sweet man, and you're possessed of a truly enviable innocence. But good old Mom and good old Pop are dead. You know, I'm broken up about it, too. I mean, really. But that particular vaudeville act is playing the cloud circuit now, so I don't see how I can look at them all neat and framed. Besides, or rather, to be pointed about it, good old Mom walked out on good old Pop when I was 10 and a half years old. She embarked on an adulterous turn of our southern states, a journey of a year's duration.
That was from Zoo Story. That's Jerry talking. Jerry talking. He's played by Frederick Weller. Now let's listen to the opening play of the evening, Home Life.
We should what? We should what?
What? We should what?
We should what?
Oh, we should talk.
I was reading, I'm sorry.
It happens so often.
Sorry.
No, that's not what I meant.
What?
You read, so you get so involved reading more all the time.
Deepening concentration. Deepen concentration. Work.
Once I talked to you for, it seemed minutes, about, the fireplace, I think, and you didn't hear a word. You were reading.
The ears turn off. Out, rather. The fireplace, really?
The andirons.
What was wrong with that? With the andirons?
Nothing, really. I was wondering if I should clean them, if I should wash them.
Why?
What?
Why you should wash them?
Well, I noticed the fire had made them all gray and sort of matte, and I wondered if we liked that.
Had we? Liked that?
I don't know. We never had the conversation.
Joanna Day as Anne and Peter, played by Frank Wood, they never have the conversation, Edward. And what's interesting to me, listening to the monologue by Jerry that we heard first from 40 years ago, is today it seems, at least in this play, it's an exceptionally terse style that you found, a terse way of expressing what maybe 35 years ago you might have had in explosive, volcanic language.
Well, if you follow Home Life all the way through, it does become quite volcanic by the end. But these are polite, reserved, rather shy people, even in their marriage. And they deal with each other with that particular kind of reserve. By the end of the play, you get your explosions.
Mm. And
why'd you do them in the reverse order?
Why did we do them in the reverse order? my senior producer will whisper in my ear and tell me. I thought that the difference between then and now was quite instructive. And
that's what I don't like about excerpts. They don't really tell you anything. You know, if do the whole play, then you'll see that of course they're different plays about different people. But anyway.
Are you satisfied that they now make the whole?
It seems to me that while the two of them are still individual plays and can be performed separately, they can be. I do think that the putting the two of them together in the proper order, however, with Home Like first and then the Zoo Story, makes a more comprehensive evening. Yes,
840.
And most of the audiences who've been to see it. Feel so, and most of the critics. I've read four reviews of the evening at the Hartford Stage Company. Three of them were favorable and intelligent.
So you acknowledge that you read reviews. I have playwright friends who don't read their reviews.
I read them. I wish I could read them more often to find out how I'm practicing my craft, but I usually read them to find out how long a play is going to run. Because most of the critics can't tell me how to practice my craft. Anyway, three of the four were very favorable and intelligent, and one of them was unfavorable and stupid. Now, it wasn't stupid because it was unfavorable, but it was unfavorable because it was stupid.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Shelley is calling from Newport, Rhode Island.
Good morning.
Good morning, Shelley.
Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. What a wonderful way to start the day. I'm very pleased to hear Mr. Albee speaking. Very intelligent man.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And I saw you at Syracuse University many moons ago giving a little talk, I believe, about Virginia Woolf. And I have my own tape of that. And when I feel I need a shot of adrenaline, I watch that because I think, there is something else in the world besides just talking about nothing. And when you said at the beginning of the program, you know, that people, I don't think you used the word apathetic, but I have never seen so much apathy about the world as I have today. And it truly frightens me.
It is interesting that people seem to be retreating from participating.
Exactly.
And it's frightening because among other things, it kills democracy.
Well, we are killing it, and I see two young people in their 40s who don't read a newspaper. They're bringing children up. They don't read a newspaper.
But, Shelley, do you find that they go to the theater?
No.
Do you think that the theater is one place in our cultural life stream where you can demonstrate that you're not apathetic?
Yes, I do. I do. Yes, I do. I do, very much so.
And, why?
Why? Because you have free rein there. You have free rein to tell a story and to have people stir you up. It's like the two masks. And if you can, you know, have something dramatic enough to stir people's feelings up, then you've got it. You've got an elixir there. And that's what I think. And I think I don't like that word, where you have a message. But if it's subtle enough and done well enough, there is a message.
Yeah, one of the most interesting differences between live theater and film and television is exactly that. It is live. It is happening while you are experiencing it. And you believe it. When you go to a movie, you know that it hasn't happened. You know it's artificial. And all of your responses are ultimately synthetic in a movie. But in a play, which is dangerous at its very best, your responses are real. Unfortunately, it's damned expensive.
That's a big change from when you started out, though, Edward. Because I mean, there was a point. I mean, in the '60s, the theater was the art form. I mean, thinking of experimental groups that we know today, like the Worcester Group. Most of those guys started out as art students, and they didn't want to paint. They didn't want to paint. It wasn't cool. It had all been done. You know, I mean, abstract expression has just taken art to a certain place in American society, and they took all of this aesthetic ideas, and they went to New York and. They started experimental theater companies, and it was the art form, and it was a place, because of its liveliness, that people could go to a demonstration, they go to the theater, and it was, in some ways, it was often the same thing, but that's not the case anymore.
Well, it was inexpensive to do, which is nice, but the most important thing is that particular period in our history, people were interested in experimenting, audiences and creative people alike, and sharing the particular experiment. We've closed down a lot as a society, unfortunately, but the economics are crippling. When we did the Zoo Story and Crap's Last Tape at the Provincetown Playhouse in New York City in 1960, the total expense of producing those two plays off-Broadway was $2,400. Now, if we bring Peter and Jerry, for example, into New York, that'll cost about $700,000. It's preposterous. And theater prices, used to be $3 to go in to see Crap's Last Tape and the Zoo Story. And now, if we do Peter and Jerry in New York, it's going to cost people $45 to go to the theater. It's crippling. And there's nothing to be done about it.
And there's nothing that can be done. I mean, people who work in the theater are entitled to make a living wage, too, and since they generally
and
have
And they
to...
make a lot less money than they would in television or in film.
Now, I know that you concentrate very
which is,
well.
Let me finish. Yeah. Which is, I get on my soapbox, okay. But I'll get off very quickly. Okay. Which is unfortunate because our theater is participated in basically only by middle-aged, well-to-do white people. And we have that is not the nature of the audience that most people who write serious theater are trying to reach. We want to reach young people. We want to reach minorities. We want to reach people who are at a lower economic level so we can make some social change in this country. But the ticket prices are so high, we can't reach them.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Just to pick up on that point... when you say theater, I mean, you're talking about the experience of going to a house with the audience will be more or less in the dark. There'll be either a proscenium, a thrust, or even in the round where something is performed. But is it possible to take a broader view of what the theatrical experience is and say that if you see a live performance that isn't a play but is something about expressing shared experience and people can get up and dance or, laugh together or look at somebody they don't know and see them crying, that could also be a valid experience and it doesn't have to happen at the Provincetown Playhouse.
The important word there is live, that it is a live experience. It becomes a theatrical experience through its being alive, yes.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mitch is on the line from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hello, it's an honor to get to hear Mr. Albee. Great.
Hey, good morning.
I had a question. You said something, Mr. Albee, that piqued my interest about your process of artistic creation. And I wonder if you can...
I'm probably lying so other people
yeah.
know how to do
no,
it.
No, but I think there's something to what you said that relates to the end product. You said that you don't think about a lot of, theoretical things or messages or symbols and this kind of stuff. And I wonder if in universities and, fashions and criticism have damaged our ability to receive art or indeed understand what drama is about. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, people have to make a living. And there are a lot of people who make a living by publishing unnecessary books theorizing about all of the arts. A lot of books get written about my process and the stuff that I've written, and I don't read too many of them because I don't read as much fiction as I used to. But none of it is a substitute for the experience of the piece. I prefer to go to see a play before I've read the critics.
Oh, absolutely.
I want the fresh experience before my enthusiasm is destroyed by a ridiculous bad review.
Mitch, are you a writer?
Yeah, I'm a critic and writer.
A critic and writer.
A critic and writer. You're a social critic, you mean?
Yeah.
Or are you a critic?
Well, you know, if you want to, I suppose I'm a critic, but I do some social criticism.
Have you ever attempted writing a play?
No, I used to write plays when I was a child.
They were all did,
dreadful,
yes.
Dreadful one act experiments that will never see the light of day. Again, hopefully.
What do you mean about when you were a child? What, eight?
Actually, younger. I was writing plays at six, seven, eight.
That
was,
see,
when I was a child, I was a fan of Pinter. Pinter was really
most of those get on Broadway. The ones that are written when people are six or eight.
Yeah. I was really a fan of Albee and Pinter. Those were always
when you were six or eight.
Mm-hmm. At that age.
You must have paid a heavy price in the playground when you talked about your interests.
Yeah, you bet.
And both Harold and I. Most influenced by Sam Beckett, of course, who you must have liked also.
Yeah, Mitch, you're still there. We're coming to the end of the segment. Just a quick question. All joking aside, you obviously felt an affinity in your mind towards the theater. Do you still have that affinity?
I try to go to the theater as much as I can. I try to support local theater. I live in Boston, and when I'm in New York, I try to go to the theater in New York.
And is there much out there that interests you, or are you going out in hope that it will someday again?
There's new plays. I mean, I'm excited by Carol Churchill's new plays. I mean, there's things out there that I see, but you know, there's so much out there, it's hard to see everything. It's not, you know, there's a lot to see.
Okay. Mitch, I want to thank you for that call. Connection listeners, what are you excited by in the theater? Talk to Edward Albee about it. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, the number to call. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour with Edward Albee, playwright. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK are the numbers to call to join in the conversation. Edward, just before the break, our caller Mitch was telling us about some of the plays he's digging at the moment. What are you digging at the moment?
Well, I wanted to finish. Thank you. I wanted to finish up replying to something Michael said. He was talking about how difficult it is to see a lot of theater, and it's expensive, and it's usually taking place only in a few cities. Plays are literature, and they can be read. And reading a play, which is not difficult to learn how to do, is a very satisfying experience. You can read a lot of wonderful new plays because they're published, and you don't have to be burdened with a bad production. You can see a very good production of a play by reading it.
That's a very interesting comment. Usually, you know, we think that playwrights are writing for the audience, and the idea of being able to stand in the back of the house. But you're writing clearly. You're writing with the intention that your plays be read as literature as well.
Well, it's an act of communication. Whether it takes place reading the play on the page or seeing it in the theater is basically the same thing. Plays do not come to life only when they're performed.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Edward is on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to speak with you. Mr. Albee, I imagine you don't watch a lot of television, but I was wondering what you think of the reality show phenomena, especially as it relates to your art, and specifically about whether there is a danger of allowing theater and other forms of presentation fiction be transformed into essentially losing the abstraction and being too close to reality in the historical sense. I'm disturbed by what I see.
So I'm disturbed by what I see, too. I do watch television. I watch it, the informational programs for information. And sometimes when it's time to deaden the mind, I watch an awful lot of other programs. But I'm appalled by these so-called reality shows. I find them manipulative and cynical and contrived and totally unrealistic. And people watching them, it's a form of masturbation.
They purport to kind of cut out the middleman. We don't need dramatists because real life is so dramatic. And I'm wondering how you feel about the drama of real life as it's put forward. I think that was Edward's question, really. Do you think that real life, unmediated, can be dramatic?
Everything has to have a shape. And all drama is making a series of choices as to what is to be explored and how it is to be explored. Real life, sure, the essence of it, but everything has got to be brought down to definable and clear parameters for it to have dramatic sense and dramatic shape. In that way, there is no such thing as a naturalistic play.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Misha is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello?
Misha.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Orlby. I grew up in Moscow, Russia, in the totalitarian society, and my question is, do you believe that any of your plays may produce some social impact? And if yes, what's an artist in a modern dark time society can do?
There's no point, I find, in writing a play just to do escapist entertainment. I do believe that all art to be useful is socially responsible. I used to go to the then Soviet Union back in the bad days and discover which ones of my plays were being performed. Not many were being allowed, but some were. The Death of Bessie Smith, for example, was very, very popular in the Soviet Union because it pointed out the extent of racial prejudice in the United States. And another play I'd written, an adaptation of a British play, Everything in the Garden, was also very, very popular because it pointed out that all middle-class American families were terribly terribly corrupt. But going to see plays in Moscow, as I did, starting in the 60s and meeting with playwrights, I had reaffirmed to me the fact that in a totalitarian society, the people who are controlled most are the creative artists and the journalists. And I found and met an awful lot of very, very brave writers in the Soviet days who took a lot of chances, making the chances that we take in this country to try to be socially responsible almost seem like child's play because some of them were going to prison camps and being silenced in terrible ways. I believe things are better now.
Misha, when you were living in Moscow, you were there in Soviet times,
yes.
Did you go to the theater much?
Yes, I went to the theater. In particular, theater on Taganka was a place where, by some strange reason, they're allowed to quite transparently explosive plays to be played there. And they produced pretty amazing impact. It was like sold out for months and months ahead of any play.
And when you've come, now you're living in Louisville, there's a fine theater in Louisville, Actors Theater.
Actors Theater, yes.
Do you go to the Actors Theater in Louisville?
Yeah, sometimes I do when I can afford it.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but do you sense any difference? Did you think that there was a greater urgency, say, at the Taganka in performances than in an American theater in a nice neighborhood in Louisville?
Well, it's a little bit too cozy. That's what I see. What's happening here? It's like more, let's say, psychological and just. I'm not familiar enough with what's happening there, basically.
Well, you mean at Actors Theatre, but I mean your impression of the difference in just theatre going between going to the theatre, going to the Taganka in Soviet times and going to Actors Theatre of Louisville.
Actors Theatre is a very fine theatre. I loved what I saw, but in Moscow in the 60s, the theatre was practically the only medium when you can hear something critical of the government. And, well, there's a very rich tradition in that sense in Moscow, and I don't see emphasis on this in theaters, you know, I'm aware of.
Misha, I want to thank you for your call. Edward, that's a very, very interesting point. I mean, in Russia, theater really was lifeblood. And
it was indeed. Of course, it was because it was live. It was real, and people were allowed. I saw the Tatanka Theater and admired it, and I also went to the Silver Menik and other theaters in Moscow and had an extraordinary time. It mattered a lot.
Does it frustrate you that kind of connection seems not to happen too much in American theater anymore?
It doesn't happen across the board, but there are some theaters that are socially and politically responsible, mostly in your major cities, where there are a lot of interesting plays going on. But you see, the basic thing is why a lot of people feel two reasons not to go to the theater. A, it's expensive, and you can't go when you want to. You have to go when it's going to be happening. And also, why should we spend a lot of money and go to be disturbed and have to think about stuff that we'd rather not think about? And most good plays, most serious good plays, are there to disturb us, to make us think. And those are two very good reasons why people don't like to go to the theater all that much.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Rick is on the line from East Greenwich, Rhode Island.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to respond real quickly to a couple of wonderful things and not so wonderful things you folks have been saying, specifically this idea that theater is dying and that it's no longer, it's strictly a white middle class pursuit. And I think maybe that's true in New York, and I think that's a very New York-centric idea. But there really is exciting theater going on in all kinds of places across the country. In Providence, for instance, there's the Second Story Theater, there's the Perishable Theater, there's a Black Repertory Theater, there's even a terrific children's theater that a few years ago won an award for the best play in New England. I also think that the idea that movies are somehow a sterile medium and that you can't have a true emotional response to a movie is also a very small point of view and a New York-centric one. That, yes, that's true of a big blockbuster, but I think there's a lot of wonderful small movies that are now getting distribution and viewership and are much more affordable in all places all around the country and in small towns in some cases. And finally, I also wanted to respond to this idea that there's this pervasive apathy both among a viewing audience and among young people in particular. I happen to be the father of two teenage daughters who are far from apathetic, who love the theater, who get tremendous emotional response from it. We go into New York frequently and do rush tickets or half-price tickets. We've seen things like Top Dog, Underdog, you know, that have been inspiring and made us think. And I think that there is people mix up cynicism with apathy, that there's a real almost political movement in this country.
Okay, Rick, let me give Edward Albee a chance to come back on all those points. Interesting.
Yeah, sorry to be so long-winded.
That's okay.
No, you weren't. I'm grateful for everything you said, and thanks for going to the theater letting your kids understand how valuable it is. You're the exception. But almost everything you mentioned also is the exception. I know there are a lot of wonderful small theaters, so to speak, that do tough, good, and wonderful work. I know there are, and I know there are a lot of people who are outside of the general theater-going audience who like to go to those theaters. But they remain the exception. Most people's taste in American theater is determined by what is happening on Broadway. Now, we all know that Broadway has very little to do with culture and very little to do with serious American drama. But most people's taste is determined by that. And a lot of our regional theaters, who we keep hoping are going to take up the slack, a lot of our regional theaters are behaving more and more like road companies of Broadway shows. Of course, there's a lot of serious theater around in smaller theaters when you want to see it, and excited audiences for that. I wish it were the majority. Unfortunately, it is still in the minority, but thank heavens for them.
And the notion of cynicism rather than apathy.
I didn't quite get the distinction he was making there.
Okay. Well, we're coming to the end of the hour, Edward, and let me ask you an enormous question that would probably take 2 hours to answer, but maybe you can do it quickly. You're still a fertile and productive artist. Are you working on anything at the moment? And what do you see the state of the theater being for whatever it is you're working on in 5 years' time?
Well, I don't concern myself with very much about what the state of theater is going to be, because I would probably be writing plays if there were no theater, because I'm a playwright, and that's what I do. Some of my plays get done in large theaters. Others are chamber plays and should be done in small theaters in front of select audiences, and that's okay too. I think I'm working on a new play. Mind you, I just finished Home Life about 6 months ago. I write a play about every year and a half. I think I'm working on a play. I think it's about identical twins, and I think it's called Me, Myself, and I. But beyond that, I can't talk much about it.
And you started this conversation by saying you never write about me. You never look at me. I'll be very interested. Well, if I can't see it, I'll be interested to read it.
That Me, Myself, and I has nothing to do with Edward Albee. It has to do with the character of the twins.
Edward Albee, thank you very, very much. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for all the work down these decades. It's made going to the theater worthwhile.
Thank you.
Connection listeners, that was Edward Albee, award-winning playwright, and his new production, Peter and Jerry, is currently playing at the Hartford Stage in Connecticut. If you're in the New England region, you can get to see it through the weekend. The Connection is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugerts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. And I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.